This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, the 3rd of December, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, President Bush once again threatens layoffs if Congress doesn't provide war funds. The House and Senate agree to a new energy bill. We'll hear why some critics say it doesn't go far enough. And Hugo Chavez is defeated in his attempt to change Venezuela's constitution. We'll hear the latest from Caracas. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Israel released 429 Palestinian prisoners today in what the Israeli cabinet says is a gesture of goodwill toward Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Free Speech Radio News's Rami Al-Magari has more.
Israel released 429 Palestinian prisoners today, leaving another 11,000 still in jail. 408 of those who were released are from the West Bank, where Abbas holds power. 21 others are from the Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip. Iyad Abiyat is a released Palestinian prisoner from the West Bank city of Bethlehem. He was imprisoned for nearly 4 years.
We hold a message from our brothers we left inside the prisons. The situation inside is extremely miserable. We urge President Abbas to take brave steps for the internal situation, mainly the Palestinian people's unity.
The prisoners who have been jailed in southern Israeli prisons were slated to be freed on the eve of the Washington-sponsored Annapolis summit last Tuesday. The release was delayed with no explanation. According to Israeli sources, the majority of those released were members of a President Abbas's Fatah party. None of them has been implicated in violent attacks against Israel. Today's release is the third in the past 5 months. In October, Israel released 86 prisoners. Another 250 or so were freed in July. None of the released prisoners belonged to Gaza's ruling party of Hamas, which rejects recognizing Israel, renouncing violence, and accepting any peace agreements. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today regarding a former Sprint employee in Kansas City who sued the company for age discrimination. The case may have crucial implications for how age and gender discrimination cases can be handled in court. Also at the High Court today, justices refused to take up the case of a Mississippi death row inmate whose lawyer had never tried a case and suffered from mental illness. The court also declined to hear the case of two members of Congress over an illegally taped telephone call. However, they did agree to take up a dispute over who owns money misappropriated by former Philippines dictator Ferdinand Marcos, a case in which the United States supports the government of the Philippines. Tomorrow, justices will hear arguments in the case of a Louisiana death row inmate who contends that race played a role in his murder conviction and sentence. Tribal peoples in the Indian state of Assam launched a highway blockade across the state as part of their campaign to gain scheduled tribe status. Bismillah Gilani reports.
The 12-hour highway blockade was called by the All Adivasi Students Association of Assam to press for their demand for scheduled tribe status so they can qualify for state benefits including education and job quotas. The Adivasis are one of the 120 communities associated with tea plantation in Assam demanding scheduled tribe status. Student bodies are asking the government to clarify its stand on the granting of such status to tribals and tea communities living in the state by December 15. In November, a similar demonstration by the tribal people turned violent when the protesters clashed with local residents. One tribal protester died and more than 250 others were injured. The government has since announced a Central Bureau of Investigation or CBI inquiry into the clashes. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
Ecuador now has a functioning constituent assembly. Today, 2 months after their election, they began the task of rewriting the nation's constitution. Joseph Muti reports from Quito.
The constituent assembly today began debating its internal structure upon which to prepare a draft constitution to be put to a national referendum for approval in 6 months' time. Working in a specially constructed building in the town of Montecristi, some 250 kilometers from the capital, the Assembly's very first act was to dissolve Ecuador's much-hated Congress, which the country's popular president, Rafael Correa, has referred to as a pit of corruption. However, a number of opposition members of Congress swore that they would be back in their seats in the defunct House after the Christmas recess. Further enraging those on the extreme right, who represent the nation's traditional oligarchy of rich families, Correa said that he hoped that one of the earliest tasks to be completed by the assembly would be a restructuring of the taxation system so that those with money would begin paying their share. With nearly 80% of the electorate behind him, the president, whose supporters hold 80 of the Constituent Assembly's 130 seats, says that Ecuador has begun its legal and structural path toward 21st century socialism. In Quito, Ecuador, this is Joseph Muti for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
World governments are meeting for a key UN climate summit that will attempt to reach a deal on what should replace the Kyoto Protocol, which ends in 2012. Talks will center on whether binding targets are needed to cut emissions. It's the first such meeting since the IPCC, a panel of leading scientists, concluded that climate change was very likely caused by human activity. FSRN's Rebecca Henschke reports from Indonesia.
The annual high-level meeting organized by the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC, is under pressure to deliver a global agreement on how to cut rising greenhouse gas emissions. Rachmat Witala, the Indonesian Environment Minister, who was named as president of the conference, pledged to do his best to deliver a deal.
Nations have experimented with different policies and measures. The market has been operational for a while. There are cleaner technologies available. We have developed tools to address the problem. Now, what we need to find is the political will to do so.
UNFCCC Executive Director Jo de Borg urged the international community to use the summit to take concrete steps towards curbing climate change. At the top of the conference's agenda is the need to reach a consensus on how to curb emissions beyond 2012. This marks the end of the current phase of the Kyoto Protocol, which commits industrialized nations to cut carbon dioxide emissions by at least 5% from 1990 levels. The talks received an immediate boost as Australia's new Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, announced he had ratified the Kyoto Protocol.
I'm pleased to inform the conference that Australia will move to immediately ratify the Kyoto Protocol.
Thank you. That was a very enthusiastic appreciation for this message.
The move by Prime Minister Rudd, who will also travel to Bali, leaves the United States as the only advanced economy yet to ratify the protocol. The conference is also scheduled to consider how to fund projects that will help developing nations deal with the impact of climate change. Mr. Jo de Borg warned that Bali and other idyllic places vulnerable to climate change were destined to become lost paradises unless drastic action was taken. He stressed that much can be achieved before the environmental ministers arrive at the conference on the 10th of December.
And this includes agreeing on the framework for the Adaptation Fund so it can start funding real adaptation projects. Agreeing on the framework for technology cooperation for the next few years to facilitate access by developing countries to the technologies that they need. Agreeing on the initial phase of actions to reduce emissions from deforestation in developing countries and agreeing on further work to support adaptation action in least developed countries.
Recently, the UNFCCC itself announced that greenhouse gas emissions from 40 of the world's richest nations rose to a near all-time high in 2005. While ahead of the Bali meeting, the Nobel-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned that damage to the Earth's weather systems this century would doom poor countries to worse hunger, water stress, and damage from violent storms. Nearly a third of plant and animal species could be wiped out. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rebecca Henschke in Indonesia.
After weeks of waiting, the U.S. House and Senate have finally come to an agreement on energy policy. Fuel economy standards will see an increase, but critics say the bill doesn't go far enough. FSRN correspondent Matt Laszlo has this report.
Clean energy now! Clean energy now! Clean energy now.
Environmental activists gathered at the U.S. Capitol today. They urged lawmakers to go as far as possible in reforming U.S. energy policy. Both chambers of Congress will soon vote on a new energy bill, the House as early as Wednesday. Brent Blackwelder is president of Friends of the Earth.
The current reality that we need to face up to, the political reality, is these bills are about as good as we can get now.
The bills were passed separately by the House and Senate in the summer. The Senate bill includes tough increases for automobile fuel efficiency, or CAFE, standards. But the House didn't have that, because House Speaker Nancy Pelosi didn't think her diverse caucus would accept that provision. Now, in a new deal with the Senate, the full fuel efficiency increases are included. Blackwelder says it's a step in the right direction.
The energy bill, which the Democratic leadership is putting together, has some very promising steps forward in it. And they are to be saluted, because this is a decisive break with the weak and counterproductive bills which the Republican leadership has put forward over the past decade.
The bill would force the fuel standards for all cars and light trucks to be raised by 40%. It also mandates utility companies to use wind and solar power for 15% of their electricity. But one major provision that the House had originally approved is not in the bill. That chamber was able to pass a $16 billion rollback of tax provisions for oil and coal companies. Last year, the oil industry spent over $37 million on campaign contributions. Nadine Block of Oil Change International says that is unacceptable.
Ultimately, Congress's inability to reduce the polluters, the oil and gas industry's polluting influence and subsidies, has to do with how beholden they are to campaign contributions and lobbying perks from the oil industry.
Ted Glick is the coordinator for the U.S. Climate Emergency Council. He has been fasting since September to highlight the need to combat global warming. FSRN talked to him after the rally about his fast and the new energy compromise.
This is the 91st day. It was started on September 4th because that was the day Congress was coming back from their summer recess. Nancy Pelosi, when she came into office now almost a year ago, she said that she wanted to have global warming legislation passed by July 4th. Here it was September 4th. Not only was global warming legislation not passed, but there really wasn't any global warming legislation on the table.
He joined thousands of people fasting on September 4th, but he has kept it going. Now Glick says he is happy with the new energy proposal, especially the increased CAFE standards. But Glick says in comparison to other countries, the U.S. is still behind.
It has to be kept in perspective. The bill projects 35 miles per gallon average for U.S. cars about 13 years from now, by 2020. Right now in Europe, the average fuel efficiency for cars in Europe is 40 miles per gallon. In China, it's already 35 miles per gallon. The U.S. is behind the curve compared to most of the rest of the world in terms of that issue and many other issues.
Glick says the fast will end this month after the Senate votes on the energy bill. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The standoff between the president and Congress over war funds intensified today. Bush is once again threatening layoffs and safety shortages for soldiers in the field if Congress doesn't provide money soon. All this on the first day Congress returns for their final stretch of legislative action before the end of the year. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
War funding is just one of the issues the president and Congress are battling over. President Bush says Democrats withholding $50 billion of war funds is unconscionable.
Yet some in Congress are withholding this funding because they want to substitute their judgment for that of our military commanders. Instead of listening to the judgment of General Petraeus, they are threatening to withhold money he needs unless they can mandate an arbitrary date of withdrawal.
The president says soon the Pentagon will be forced to take money from the Army budget, forcing the layoff of 100,000 civilian personnel and cutbacks on programs designed to detect and protect troops from roadside bombs, all to pay for the war, the president says. The time frame for such action differs, the president says, as soon as January, and the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service says that scenario is a few months away. Regardless, the fight over war funding is expected to intensify in coming weeks, as Democrats promise to withhold the money for the remainder of the year, forcing the president to choose between war funding with conditions or no money at all. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
We offered $50 billion more with minimal strings attached. The answer is no. All we ask in return is some accountability and some, at least a strategy. We believe it will be successful. We would like to refocus on terrorism. We would like to strengthen our military. I repeat, which is at its breaking point. Republicans have refused our offer.
In November, the House of Representatives passed a $50 billion Iraq funding bill. It required the president to begin withdrawing troops within 30 days, with a non-binding goal of bringing most troops home by December 2009. Many progressive leaders hailed the legislation, saying it's the first time a funding bill was written in such a way that required the president to use the money for a troop withdrawal, not to continue the combat operations in Iraq. Standing behind the president, Republicans in the Senate blocked the measure, leading to the current standoff. And Senate Republican leaders continue to stand by the president. Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell.
Well, we know already from the multiple votes that we've had this year what won't get a presidential signature, any kind of surrender date or any kind of congressional micromanagement of the war, even if it were adequate on the funding side, is not going to get a signature, and we do need to get a signature here.
War funding isn't the only issue at stake. The president also drew attention to other must-pass priorities for Congress in the next 3 weeks, including appropriation bills. Only one of the 12 appropriation bills have been signed into law. The president has threatened to veto nearly all of them because they total a mere $22 billion more than he requested. Other crucial legislation to be passed before December's end are the Farm Bill, reforms to the U.S. surveillance program, and a repeal to the alternative minimum tax, a tax that infiltrated middle-income families due to inflation. Republican leaders would like to see a deal that encompasses the Iraq funding bill and all appropriation bills. Democrats have not conceded to that approach. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
In an unprecedented decision, on the heels of massive street demonstrations, millions of Venezuelans went to the polls over the weekend. The result? The Venezuelan opposition gained its first victory over President Hugo Chavez in 9 years, defeating his constitutional reform referendum yesterday by a margin of less than 2%. FSRN's Mike Fox has more from Caracas.
If past Sunday's constitutional reform would have lowered the work week to 36 hours, created a social security fund for the self-employed, and passed more power down to Venezuela's people through the communal councils. It would also have eliminated presidential term limits and given increased power to President Hugo Chavez, which appears to have pushed opposition voters to the polls in greater numbers. Results were read early this morning by Tibisay Lucena, president of the National Electoral Council, solidifying an important victory for the sector against the reform.
Block A, the no option, 4,504,354, with a 50.7%. The yes, 4,379,392, with a percentage of 49.29%.
President Chavez immediately recognized the opposition victory rather than attempt a recount or wait for the incoming paper ballots.
Can you imagine if this were to be drawn out all day today, all day tomorrow, and all day Tuesday? No. No, no. So before the country and before the world.
The elections came 2 days after Chavez announced to a crowd of hundreds of thousands of supporters that if the U.S. meddled in the Venezuelan elections, he would stop exporting oil to the United States. Chavez supporters awoke before 4 a.m. yesterday and began to line up outside the polling places. Voting throughout the country was calm, without any major incidents, and faster than in previous years. Independent international election observers from over 50 countries were in Venezuela for the referendum. Paul-Emile Dupré is a lawyer and member of the European Parliament from Belgium who observed yesterday's elections and verified that everything was running smoothly.
Every group we have visited so far, about 5 or 6 centers so far. And so far we haven't seen any trouble. The queues are not too big. And also we see that the process is more organized. The CNE, the electoral body, is managing better. And I think really that it will confirm that in this country now they have a very serious electoral system. So I must say that this is more transparent and more modern system than the one I know in my country, in Belgium.
But the day was not without passion from both the pro- and anti-reform camps. 2 hours before the close of the voting centers, opposition student leader Yon Goicochea called on Venezuelans to vote against the reform.
We've had more than 5 months in the streets where this movement has grown in force across the nation. The only thing I ask for the Venezuelan people is that you go execute your right to vote. Ladies and gentlemen, today can change the history of Venezuela. The more people vote, the more hope there is for Venezuela. And the more that people vote, the more hope there is for the future.
As the afternoon wore on and with the vote still too close to call, Venezuela was tense with rumors of potential opposition violence and protests in the case that the reform were to pass. Finally, the results in favor of the no vote were announced shortly after midnight Eastern Daylight Time. Chavez called this weekend's referendum his most important election yet and said the changes were necessary to make the shift towards 21st century socialism. Although the nearly 70-article reform did not pass, Chavez says he will continue to push for the implementation of his proposals through non-constitutional means.
We continue in the battle of constructing socialism under the framework in which the Constitution permits. I want you to know that I will not retire not one comma of this proposal. It continues to be a proposal of the people of Venezuela. This proposal is still alive.
According to some international analysts, the result of the election may actually be a positive for Chavez, as it proved to the opposition and his international critics that the Venezuelan president was willing to accept the rules of Venezuelan democracy. Nearly 9 million Venezuelans voted yesterday, which is just over 50% of total registered voters. Michael Fox, FSRN, Caracas.
Nawaz Sharif, leader of the Pakistan Muslim League, that nation's second largest political party, has announced that the party will not take part in the country's general elections on January 8. His decision came after the Election Commission barred him from taking part in the elections because of his alleged involvement in hijacking the plane in which current President Pervez Musharraf was returning home from Sri Lanka in 1999. FSRN's Masroor Hussein takes a look at what Sharif's announcement means for Pakistan's political stability.
Just when things seem to have settled down among the country's political elite, Nawaz Sharif has dropped a bombshell decision not to partake in the elections, which could throw the country back into turmoil. But Benazir Bhutto refused to go with him on this. Musharraf Khan teaches at Karachi University.
I think this is not a good decision because the public is waiting for the democracy. There should be some elected government. And the decision of the Nawaz Sharif is not fair because the other parties are also interested to take the part in that. Otherwise, how we will have a good government? And public is interested in their benefits, in fact. We are not interested, sir, just a dictator will come and he will continue his government for a long time.
When he sat with Benazir Bhutto to convince her not to take part in the elections, he changed his mind. Mohammed Farhan is a student.
Absolutely. Elections should always be free and fair, but the situation in Pakistan, which has brought nothing but problems, is because there are no fair and free elections in the country. This is exactly the problem.
Earlier in the day, soon after hearing about his disqualification, Nawaz Sharif rushed to the religious leader Qazi Hussain Ahmed and then to chairperson of People's Party Benazir Bhutto, apparently for the support in this new movement to boycott elections, which is likely to take the shine off the coming elections, which is Musharraf's big achievement. Mohammed Farhan.
Nawaz Sharif has decided to boycott the elections. This is his own decision, but I think this will disturb the legitimacy of the elections.
Bhutto's decision not to stand with Sharif on staying away from the polls has once again saved the day for Musharraf. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Masroor Hussain, Karachi.
Public hearings are underway this month to determine whether the state of Maine will allow more than 400,000 acres of forest land to be rezoned to allow the largest development ever proposed in the state's history. From WERU in East Orland, Maine, Amy Brown reports.
Will the moose, deer, and lynx return after the roads have been built? Will we survive if Plum Creek turns our culture of subsistence into one of servitude? Mainers, send Plum Creek and their stupid ideas back to Seattle!
Timber company and real estate developer Plum Creek, the largest private landowner in the country, has requested rezoning of land around the pristine Moosehead Lake region in northern Maine. When they bought the land in 1998, It was sold to them for less than $200 an acre because it was zoned only for use for forestry, wildlife protection, and backcountry recreation. Now that the trees have been cut, Plum Creek would like to make even more profit by building massive luxury resorts and housing developments catering to summer homeowners. This is a pattern Plum Creek has repeated across the country as they have shifted from logging to real estate development. The Yellowstone Club, built on formerly public land in Montana, and Suncadia in Washington State are two resorts catering to millionaires built on land that once belonged to Plum Creek. In Maine, the area in which they propose to build the resorts is prime habitat for the threatened Canada lynx, as well as loons, brook trout, and many other species. Jason Hughes is a lifelong resident of Greenville, a small town on Moosehead Lake. As the paper companies have shut down and giant logging companies are liquidating their land, jobs have left the region. Hughes supports the Plum Creek plan and hopes it will attract jobs to the area.
I'm not sure that this plan is the perfect plan, but having a plan for our area might help us to restore what used to be here. We've been steadily losing jobs and people for the last several decades. It would be nice to see some of those trends reversed.
But others are fearful that Maine would be trading an irreplaceable wilderness area for a few service economy jobs serving rich summer homeowners. Lisa D. Hart is a registered Maine river guide. She thinks it can only lead to sprawl.
We've all driven south. Look like Shangri-La down there. The sprawl, the strip malls, the Starbucks. Are those the good jobs or are they coming? Trophy homes. That's what this basically comes down to. So rich people can build a house so big that perfect strangers will drive by and think they're all that and a bag of chips. I don't think there's no amount of money or jobs or whatever that they can promise that's worth having the Moosehead Lake region look like south of here.
Plum Creek was once called the Darth Vader of the timber industry by a Republican senator in their home state of Washington. Since the company bought land in Maine in 1998, they have destroyed deer yards, polluted streams, developed a power line corridor without a permit, and received the largest fines in the state's history for 18 violations of the Maine Forest Practices Act. Environmentalists in other parts of the country have strong warnings about Plum Creek. Maine resident Don Roberts heard some of them on a bike trip through the western states this summer.
They were emphatic in their condemnation of Plum Creek's exploitive profiteering in their home state. Plum Creek will promise anything, they said, and then proceed to rape the land. The corporation is willing to pay what they think of as the paltry fines imposed on them. The profits are so huge. Don't let Plum Creek do to your beautiful state what they have done to ours was a refrain.
The Maine Land Use Regulatory Commission will receive public comments through the end of the month before deciding whether to approve Plum Creek's rezoning plan. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Amy Brown from WERU in East Orland, Maine.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. This newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast online at fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments at fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.